It's Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we talk to the independent candidate running for Congress in Wisconsin's 6th District.
First, yesterday in Las Vegas, Nevada, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton took the stage as part of the third and final presidential debate.
The matchup, moderated by Chris Wallace of Fox News, tackled the issues of Second Amendment rights and the Supreme Court, abortion, and immigration.
And both candidates were pressed about the scandals plaguing their individual campaigns, such as the sexual assault allegations being leveled against Donald Trump.
Along with the ongoing email controversies surrounding Hillary Clinton, which was exacerbated after WikiLeaks dumped thousands of her campaign's emails on the internet.
Joining us now to talk about the debate is Julia Azari. She's an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. Julia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we'll delve into the policy issues in just a bit, but I want to step back and talk about the storyline that's really playing out right now. It carries over from the debate and about the challenging the outcome. Last night, Donald Trump said he'd keep us in suspense. And today at a rally in Ohio, he went further with this message.
I would like to promise and pledge to all of my voters and supporters, and to all of the people of the United States, that I will totally accept the results of this great and historic presidential election if I win.
So the caveat there, if I win. Julia, as a political scientist, what was your reaction to this?
Well, I think my reaction was similar to the reaction of people of all different professional educational backgrounds, which is that the essence of what makes a democracy functional is accepting the institutions and accepting some legitimacy on the part of the other side, accepting that that the other side might disagree with you, but that they're still a legitimate part of the system. And that's what's being rejected here. And I think it's very hard to get around the fact that even playing around with this rhetoric is really not the norm.
And the subject of abortion came up last night, specifically the topic of late-term partial birth abortions. Hillary Clinton was asked specifically about this topic, and her answer was that she supported late-term abortions if the mother's life was in danger or if the baby was going to die after being born. Here is Donald Trump's response.
Hillary can say that that's okay, but it's not okay with me. Because based on what she's saying and based on where she's going and where she's been, you can take the baby and rip the baby out of the womb in the 9th month on the final day. And that's not acceptable.
Well, that is not what happens in these cases. And using that kind of scare rhetoric is just terribly unfortunate. You should meet with some of the women that I've met with, women I've known over the course of my life. This is one of the worst possible choices that any woman and her family has to make. And I do not believe the government should be making it.
So what do you make of how these candidates approached their answers to this question?
So on one level, this was pretty typical for what we expect from Republicans and Democrats. And this, I thought, was one example of Trump having really embraced the standard Republican position. On the other hand, there was a little bit of noise on the internet that, well, Clinton's position did channel a lot of what is a standard Democratic position, that the way she articulated it as a woman, and especially defending the reasons behind late-term abortions, which sometimes Democrats have been more hesitant to do, that was a little bit unique. So I would say it pretty much illustrates the kind of party polarization on social issues that we've come to expect.
And Julia, Americans invested a lot of time in watching these debates. There's been reports of increased visits to therapists, certainly restless nights for Americans after watching these spectacles. Do you think these three debates got anywhere?
That's a really good question. I did have a moment last night where I was watching the debate and kind of thinking, I feel like I've seen this before. This is kind of a two-sided situation in some ways. I think it's great in some ways that people are watching the debates, that they've had high viewership, people are engaged in politics, people are, it seems, being social in their politics. But this anxiety, obviously, is not a great development. In terms of whether the debates got anywhere, I think that they showed a kind of consistency in terms of the two candidates, right? You have Trump, where there's a lot of questions about whether he's, he's not a standard Republican. He has not really been affiliated with the party up to this point. So he was, he articulated some Republican points and some not so much. He also was, we should just come out and say it, had a number of moments in these debates that were not what we expect, right? A lot of interruptions, calling Hillary Clinton a nasty woman. These things are not normal, and I think that those are important revelations. With Clinton, there was, at one point, I think this was the previous debate, where she did actually address the emails a little bit and say that she regretted it and she would do something different in the past, and I think people are looking for more of that from her. But I think we got to see a little bit of who the candidates are, so that perhaps got us somewhere with those debates.
And, as someone who has studied politics, have you ever seen a campaign season like this? Have we entered a new era of language in politics?
I think a little bit. The line that I keep coming back to, or the thing that I keep coming back to, is that the parties as organizations were proven in the nomination season to be fairly weak. Particularly the Republican Party was unable to coordinate formally or informally to prevent Trump's candidacy, which a lot of them didn't seem to want. But partisanship is strong. People's identification with the parties is strong. That's not a typical combination in American politics. Typically, when the parties have been weak, partisanship has been weaker, and at times when partisanship has been really fervent, the parties as organizations have had a fair amount of control over what goes on within them. So this is a particularly, I think, unprecedented and potent combination.
There's been so much talk of undecided voters. Do you think this third debate helped undecided voters in any such way to make a decision?
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
Do you think this final debate helped undecided voters come to any type of conclusion, a decision?
Yeah, so this is interesting. I've heard a couple of people try to talk about who would be an undecided voter in this context, and it seems like the consensus is that an undecided voter is someone who doesn't really like either candidate. I'm not sure if the debates would persuade you to like either candidate. I think that if you're somebody who is, what I have heard anyway through Twitter and other means is people who are Republicans but don't like Trump and were kind of looking for reasons to like Trump, there have been some moments there, but maybe not enough. And for people who are Democrats who are looking to like Hillary Clinton, I think that there have been enough moments to sort of hammer home a negative partisanship. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what we've been seeing after these debates, is a pretty consistent narrative that Clinton won and that Clinton, has been doing better in the polls since the debates began. And in some ways that's kind of remarkable that the debates, because they've had this sort of consistent series of events, has had a little bit more of an impact, I think, than we would normally predict.
And then does winning a debate even matter anymore?
You wouldn't think so. Some of the evidence shows that it can matter if the media thinks you won the debate and you get a bunch of
press.
Positive press afterward.
Well, and are there any final takeaways really quickly that, you walked away with after watching what you watched last night?
So I think the thing that struck me the most watching last night's debate is that Trump seems to have taken some of the standard Republican talking points and issue positions, but the thing that's consistently missing is, and this is true in the primary debates too, is a kind of articulation of a classic GOP small government philosophy, channeling of Ronald Reagan. You kind of mentioned Ronald Reagan a couple of times, but there's not a lot of talk about the value of smaller government or something along those lines, and that is a huge shift. It's a huge shift for a Republican presidential candidate, a big turn away from what we've seen in the recent past.
And we'll leave it there. That was Julia Azari, is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University.
Right now, we're continuing our series of candidate interviews for Wisconsin's 2016 congressional races. We've invited candidates running to represent Wisconsin to join us here on Central Time and on the Joy Cardine Show.
This week, we've been looking at the 6th congressional district in eastern Wisconsin, which incorporates everything from Wisconsin Dells to Oshkosh, Sheboygan, and Beaver Dam. Independent candidate Jeff Dahlke is running against Republican incumbent Glenn Grothman and Democratic candidate Sarah Lloyd. Grothman and Lloyd both joined us earlier this week, and you can hear their interviews on WPR.org.
Jeff Dahlke joins us now to talk more about his candidacy. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, why are you running for Congress?
Well, first of all, I want to make a better world for my kids and my grandkids. I don't know if we have another 10 years like we've just had, what kind of country we're going to have left. Things are in such turmoil. It seems to like most of it's coming because of the campaign finance system. There's so much money, dark money, corruption in the campaign finance system that it needs to get changed. We need to fix the Social Security. There's just so many reasons. Social Security is a big one. We need to make it solvent. We need to replay the $2.3 trillion that was stolen from that fund. National security, that's another reason. ISIS is running rampant all over the world. I believe it's in 36 countries now. Well, we need to stomp it out. We need help from other countries, but we need to get on top of that. And, of course, the education system, Common Core, it's pretty sad when a parent actually has to have classes to help their student with homework. It's ridiculous.
I understand it was a conscious decision for you to run as an independent instead of going in a primary for one of the major parties. Why was that independent label important to you?
Well, I don't want to be held to any party. All I want to do is represent the people of Wisconsin and not have to answer to a party. Once you're involved with the party, you have to play their game. If you don't answer the way you want them to answer, vote the way you want them to vote, you know where your funding is going to be for the next term? Non-existent. They won't fund you.
Can you talk some about your background, your career, and how that might help you representing Wisconsin in Congress?
Well, I worked highway construction my whole life. I was born and raised on a farm, on a dairy farm, just outside of Green Bay. The job that I have now lets me travel all over the world as a global service technician. I get to work with foreign governments, building their roads and some of their airports. I've been all over Russia, China, Indonesia, Australia. So I think that's going to help out on the long end of it.
And compare and contrast yourself a little bit to the other candidates in this race, both Republican Glenn Grothman and Democratic candidate Sarah Lloyd. Obviously, they are very different candidates from one another. How do you distinguish yourself from them?
Well, the biggest thing is I'm not a politician. I'm not a candidate with a background in Democrat or Republican. I have Democratic values. I have Republican values. I have Libertarian values. That's one of the biggest things. Also, I'm not bought and paid for by special interests. If you're part of the party, you don't know where that money's coming from, and a lot of it's dark and gray money. So that's how I believe that I differentiate myself from them. I'm a true representative of the people of Wisconsin. I've lived here my whole life. I've worked here. I've worked right along people throughout the state. I believe that's what separates me from them.
We've asked both the other candidates how they would work with or sometimes even against the presidential candidate in their own party. As a congressperson, how would you view working with a President Donald Trump or a President Hillary Clinton?
I believe that I can work with anybody. I've traveled all over the world and worked with people from, you know, of different countries. So I don't believe that would be a problem. I believe that I can work with anybody. In fact, I would enjoy working with them because I can unify the two parties.
We're talking to candidate Jeff Dahlke. He is running in Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District against incumbent Republican Glenn Grothman and Democratic candidate Sarah Lloyd, part of our series of candidate interviews over the next couple of weeks. Let's get into some particular issues now. Free trade agreements have been a huge issue in the presidential race in particular and other races as well. Things like the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership, going back to NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. What are your thoughts on these agreements?
TPP is just a bad idea. All it is an extension of NAFTA. NAFTA in itself cost Wisconsin 40,000 jobs, I believe, since it started, and we're still losing jobs because of it. We have to have, if we're going to have a trade agreement with anybody, we have to be on a fair playing field with everybody else. They don't have the wages that we have here in the States. They don't have the regulations for EPA and emissions. I've been to China, and in Lanzhou, China, you cannot see across the river from one side to the other because the pollution is so bad on any given day. We need to be fair, and even if they want to get into any kind of trade agreement on a global market, it's just not fair the way we have things set up now.
As you've said in your line of work, you deal with people in other countries. A lot of jobs in the U.S. are dependent on some form of international trade. Is it possible to negotiate good agreements that address your concerns but still keep the doors open to that kind of trade?
Well, I believe so, but that goes back to what I had just stated. We actually have to have on an even playing field. You know, we have to be apples for apples with these other countries. We are getting regulated to death on everything on a global market. We need to make things fair. And I think that we can work with people and get this done.
Now, this election cycle, it's been pretty rough around the edges at a lot of points. Approval ratings for the body you're trying to join, Congress, have been low, maybe historically low. What would you do to help improve the way, as an independent, to help improve the way Congress functions and boost its ratings among the American people?
Well, I would like to work on both sides of the aisle to actually get things done. I mean, we've had a do-nothing Congress here for the past 8 years. They really haven't done anything except fight with each other, stonewall each other. Nobody wants to do anything. I think being an independent, I would like to get there, and especially when we have our freshman orientation, get everybody together before they can get poked and prodded by their parties when everybody's there and say, hey, guys, we have the chance right now to make history. All of us freshmen, let's this be our third party. And let's work together, because you can go to your prospective parties back and forth, but I think that I can be a leader in that, in getting everybody to work together.
One issue that's been a big hang-up in the House, in particular in Congress in general, is immigration reform. What are your thoughts on immigration reform and border security?
We definitely need to do something about the border. You just can't let everybody keep walking into this country. First of all, it's not safe, especially what's happening with ISIS. I mean, you can get to Mexico and walk across the border if you want. We need to do something, but we can't just go and round up 13 million people and send them back across the border. It would cost way too much money. It's not feasible. But I have an idea that we could do on this. We could I call it a pay to stay. If you want to stay here, you give 25% of your gross for 2 years, and here you go. As long as you didn't do any crime in that amount of time, you can stay. And otherwise, you know, you give the people 1 year, make as much money as you can, and then leave. It gives, in that 1 year time, it gives the employers time to replace them. And I think it's fair and equitable. I think it's the only thing that we can do. It makes sense.
You mentioned earlier education as a top priority. What kind of change, a Common Core you'd like to see changed or gotten rid of, it sounds like. What else would you do to boost the educational system in the U.S. and in your district?
Well, I think we need to let the power go back to the states and the local governments again. The federal government is dabbling in things that they shouldn't. It's redundant. The Department of Education, other than a few grants that it gives on the college end, I mean, why not give that power back to the states where it belongs? And as far as college education, we need to do something for the college loans. They're just out of hand. I believe that you should never have to pay more than what you can get your cheapest home loan for, and make it a simple interest loan so you're not paying forever and ever and ever. I think those are two of the biggest things that we need to do. And then, of course, get rid of Common Core.
Turning to health care, the current makeup of the House, they voted multiple times in favor of repealing the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. What are your thoughts on the Affordable Care Act? What changes would you like to see made, or would you like to see it repealed outright?
Well, right now there's 29 million people that still do not have insurance, and there's another 7.5 million that would rather pay the fine because the premiums are so high. We can take a look and see what we have right now and see if there's anything that we can salvage from it. We have something in place, but if we look into it and we can't salvage it, we might actually just have to scrap the whole thing and start over. They're talking single payer, but that's not the greatest idea in the world neither. We would actually have to check with Canada on this and see where their shortfalls are. I know I've been to Canada probably about, I think, 6 weeks ago, and I was asking them about their health care there. They said, yeah, it's great. Everything's paid for, but the wait time, they said, is horrible. People just go in for any good reason. You know, if you have a cold, you have a scratch, people are going to their doctor. We need to get on top of that if we ever decide to go with a single payer.
And on your website, you mentioned workers' issues, working class Americans. What would you do as a congressperson to help them?
Well, I believe that we would actually have to work with the businesses and also with the unions. I mean, the unions in their time were a great thing, but like anything else, when you have too much people, you know, they get corruption even in that end of it. But we would need to, you know, sit down with the leaders, the businesses, and the workers, and the unions, and we can strengthen everything again by doing that. You know, unions that once upon a time, they were a great thing, but they've kind of been getting chiseled at lately because, well, part of their own doing. They need to fix their own house, and then from that end, we can start working together again to build jobs, build relations, and have things work like they used to.
And very briefly, Jeff, in our last few seconds, final thoughts for our listeners.
Just remember me on November 8th. And remember, if you want to know any more about me, go to my website, www.jeffdahlkeforcongress.com, or you can check me out on Facebook.
Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Jeff Dahlke. He's an independent candidate running for Congress in Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District. Our next guest says that, unfortunately, sexual coercion in one form or another can be as American as the baseball metaphor about sex that almost everybody's heard. It's a metaphor that sees girls' limits as a challenge boys need to overcome.
Our guest says the release of this month's Trump tapes has us talking about sexual assault and what is and isn't locker room talk. And she says that makes it a good time to talk with boys and young men about consent, respect, and reciprocity.
Peggy Orenstein joins us now. She's the author of the New York Times bestseller, Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. She's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. Peggy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, that baseball metaphor, you started at that point in the piece we referred to. Talk about that as kind of summing up a lot of this conversation lately.
Yeah, it was really an amazing moment. I was sitting in on a sex ed class, a high school sex ed class, and they were talking about something. And, you know, I really believe in the capacity for teenagers to work this out together, boys and girls, and to, you know, that there's goodwill. And at one point, this boy who was an athlete, he was wearing a school jersey, raised his hand and he said, you know, that baseball metaphor for sex, in baseball, there's winners and losers. So who's the loser supposed to be during sex? And I thought that was such an amazing moment because, you know, it was a very small thing, but he really questioned that. And I thought that's going to make a difference in how he goes into his encounters from here on out. He's going to go in much more as a partner and much less as an adversary who, as you said earlier, sees girls' limits as a challenge that they're supposed to overcome.
And you're thinking about this more in the aftermath of the release of the Access Hollywood tapes, Donald Trump talking about what he can do without consent to women, and then later saying, oh, it was locker room talk. What was your reaction when you heard first the original quotes there from 10 or so years ago, and then the justification for them later?
Well, you know, in a certain way, I thought, well, here we are again. I mean, we have so many of these cases. They come up constantly. And I've been chronicling girls' lives and issues of sexuality for over 25 years. And, you know, whether it's going back to William Kennedy Smith or looking at Steubenville or Brock Turner more recently or Bill Cosby or Donald Trump, you know, we keep finding ourselves in the same place where we see these extreme and assault behaviors, and we tend to sort of demonize them as being, you know, having nothing to do with anything else. Rather than looking at ways that maybe these are the very, very extreme and distorted end of a continuum that we need to address, that the locker room talk that he was talking about, you know, is not natural. It's not normal. You don't talk about assault, like it's a joke. And it is forming the way that boys think about masculinity, either in joining in or reacting against or staying silent.
A lot of your writing has focused on girls and young women and talking to them about sex and consent and the issues we're talking about. We need to talk, it sounds like, to boys at young ages through high school and beyond.
Yeah, you know, the girls and sex, well, I really started out looking at wanting to look at what happened after Yes. You know, we were having this huge debate about sexual assault in the culture, but that was where the conversation was ending. And, you know, when there's a vacuum of information, the media and the internet come in and teach our kids for us. And I felt like if we really wanted our young people to engage safely, ethically, and enjoyably, whether they were, you know, engaging when they were teenagers or after they were married or whatever, we had to talk about what happened next. And so I went out to talk to girls about that and ended up with far more stories about coercion and assault than I had imagined I would. And after doing that for 3 years and writing the book, I realized that, you know, it's a dance between two people. And when we're talking about heterosexual encounters, to just talk about girls and what's going on with them was really only having half the conversation. So now I'm interviewing and talking to young men and writing a new book.
Talking to Peggy Orenstein about sex, consent, and the genders. She's the author of Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. So there's this template for young men. And as I was reading your piece, I was thinking of the song from Greece, Summer Love. And then you actually quoted it midway through.
You were thinking of it already?
Yeah. Because there's the line, and it's... It seemed fun and wacky, I guess, back then. It's chilling, though, when you think about it.
Yeah.
Tell me more. Did she put up a fight?
Yeah.
So this is a long-accepted norm, almost, that there's expected to be resistance to be overcome mentally, emotionally, maybe physically. I mean, is that a long-term norm in American culture?
Absolutely. I mean, coercion is kind of baked into the process. Yeah, I saw that. They did Fox TV did a production of Grease Live a couple months ago, and I was watching it. And, you know, that's a family, it's a family musical. And they got to that line, and I just thought, what? I hadn't remembered that line, you know? But it's not even, I don't know. It's just seen as a sort of normal course of things that boys are supposed to push and girls are supposed to be the inertia that stops their, you know, unstoppable libido. And that's the way that we've presumed things to be. And that's the way that we see it in pop culture. And that's the way that they see it in internet porn. And, you know, one of the things that I really felt after writing about girls was that as little as we talk to young women about sexuality and consent and all these issues, we talk to young men less. And I felt that we were just sort of throwing them out there and expecting them to find their way and leaving them really to be educated by these old ideas and by the media and by the internet.
Yeah, when we talk about and to boys about sex, is the message mostly negative? Here's the bad thing, don't do that, but there's not a roadmap to positive masculinity when it comes to sex?
Yeah, you know, I think that what we used to say to boys is don't get a girl pregnant. And now a more modern parent will say, and by the way, don't rape her. But we don't talk about, so what, you know, again, what happens after Yes? How do you negotiate a sexual relationship that, you know, one of the educators that I talk to in Girls and Sex talks about trying to guide teenagers towards making decisions that end in honor and integrity rather than guilt and shame. So, you know, how do we guide our kids, our boys and our girls, towards that goal, whether, again, they're engaging in an encounter that's going to last for 5 minutes or one that's going to be, you know, lasting for 50 years of their lives?
Is this a hard sell in a society where we're often reluctant to talk to maybe teens about sex at all, or maybe just, as you said, don't get somebody pregnant, don't get a disease, don't rape people, and that's it, that's the sex talk?
By the way, we don't say don't get a disease as much to boys as we should. We say that more to girls. But I don't know. In writing about girls, I've been overwhelmed by how positively the book was received and how really hungry people were for this conversation around young women. I'll be really curious as I go through this process with boys to find out if there is an equal hunger and desire to talk about their half of the conversation and to question some of the norms of masculinity. And I don't know. I sure hope so, because I think that we're not serving our boys very well either right now.
You're in the midst of this project. You're talking to boys. Do they want to talk about this? Do you sense a hunger for boys to have this conversation, to have better information?
They do. You know, I mean, I am just sort of at the beginning, but I've been really touched by the young men that I've talked to. And I've, you know, sometimes they get sort of teary. And, you know, and just talking about that idea of masculinity, one of the boys that I talked to, who I mentioned in the article, he was telling me how he worked at a bicycle shop in Northern California over the summer, and that all day long, he said the guys in the shop talked in an incredibly degrading way about women, and at the more G-rated, you know, broadcast-friendly end of that spectrum, they actually, I don't know if I can say this on air. I'll just use
the B word.
The B word. Yeah, The cafe down the street was staffed by young women, and they referred to it as the B word. And they would say, "Hey, you want to go get coffee at the B word?" And he didn't engage with that. He didn't, you know, participate. But he also didn't say anything. And he said, "You know, I put my head down, and I just did my job. I was just there for the summer." And I totally got that on one level. But then on the other level, listening to the Trump tapes and thinking, how many guys on that bus who were laughing were really thinking, "Oh God, get me out of here." You know, how many guys on that bus who said nothing were thinking they were the good guys because they weren't participating, but they also weren't challenging it.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Door County. Jeff, hi.
Hey, how are you guys? Interesting conversation, and I think it's surprising, but maybe not, that this aspect of the election and the comments by a potential front runner, the impact it has on kids. As a teacher, the stuff that I hear kids talking about are the things that fill their head, and they're not able to discern because they're kids. Is really, really important, and it's impactful, and no one's talking about it.
So, Jeff, are you saying you're hearing kids say things that they've heard in this presidential campaign race?
Well, they joke about what they heard, and, you know, I mean, I know that we're on the bus thing now, but, you know, earlier there was talk about the wall, and I guess the point I'm making is that the words of this individual, while as adults we can maybe kind of, you know, decide if it's just rhetoric or what. Kids can't. And these kids, this stuff has an impact.
Thank you for the call, Jeff. Peggy, what are your thoughts? Does this have an impact on kids, on teens?
Yeah, I think, you know, it certainly does, to see one of the people that is ostensibly the most respected in the land talking that way. It completely legitimizes it for young people. And I think it, you know, I'm always looking for sort of silver linings. And I think that the silver lining is that it gives us the opportunity to say, stop. We need to have a conversation with our children, not just one conversation, but many conversations about what it means to be respectful, about what it means to be a good citizen. And that includes being, you know, a good sexual citizen, being a good citizen in a relationship. What are our expectations for the way our kids behave, and recognizing that they are being bombarded, whether they're male or female, with sexualized images of women, with, you know, media that commercialize and distort sexuality, with internet porn, with all these things. And it's up to us as parents and as educators to both protect them and also help them sort those things out in a way that will allow them to treat their partners well.
We're talking with Peggy Orenstein. She's the author of the book Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. We're talking more about boys and sex and the national conversation we're having about issues of sex and consent, in part in the wake of the Donald Trump Access Hollywood tapes.
And we want to know what you think. What kind of conversation are you having with your sons and daughters about issues of sex and consent today? How do we change the cultural standard of boys pushing for more and girls trying to set limits? And what does it mean to be a man when it comes to sexual ethics? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Peggy Orenstein stays with us. She's the author of the book Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape, working on a new book on boys and sex. We're talking about how to tell boys what it means to be a man when it comes to issues of sex and consent, partly prompted by the Donald Trump Access Hollywood tapes.
And we want to know what you think. What kind of talks are you having with your sons and daughters about issues of sex and consent? How do we change the cultural standard of boys pushing for more and girls trying to set limits? And what works when it comes to teaching boys and girls about what it means to be a man? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Peggy, I wanted to get back to something you said earlier about, I guess, kind of assumptions about from boys based on what they've heard from others about how they behave in a situation. If they're in that room with other boys talking about sex, they have assumptions about what everybody else thinks. That might be the worst, and maybe they just keep egging each other on in a way, building up that talk and maybe ultimately leading to negative action. Can you talk about the peer pressure side?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, and it's not just the talk, but it's the silence around the talk. And what has been shown in research is that when nobody challenges that kind of discussion, that it's presumed not that the people disapprove, but that they actually agree. And so silence actually perpetuates the behavior. And, you know, I think it also cuts down on what we're really trying to build right now, which is bystander action when assaults do occur. So particularly on college campuses, when there's something going down at a party, the idea that somebody would step in and challenge it and say, hey, wait a minute, is undermined when we think that, oh, well, you know, it's okay just to engage in this so-called locker room talk and talk smack about girls in locker room. And, you know, and then, you know, on the other issue is it is completely devalues the experience of gay boys as well.
Let's go back to our callers now. Harvey is with us in Boyd. Harvey, hi.
Hi. How's your day going?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
I guess I wanted to know if with the Donald Trump videos and whatnot, if the author thinks that it started well before that, or if this is kind of the beginning of that acceptance and talk and whatnot.
Peggy, you're not saying that the Donald Trump things started? No.
Oh, no, absolutely not. And in fact, I say very overtly in the piece that these episodes keep coming up with either people in power or with boys, you know, talking about Steubenville or talking about the Glen Ridge rapes in New Jersey or talking about the Spur Posse in Lakeland, California, that there's a tendency when these horrific acts occur or Brock Turner to sort of distance ourselves from them and say, you know, not our boys, not our sons. And obviously, that's true on one level. You know, it's not representative behavior of boys by any means. At the same time, if we only have this line in the sand where, you know, if you commit an assault, you know, then it's a problem. It's not enough. And we really have to talk to boys. And this is a long overdue conversation. And it's not that Donald Trump is the first person to do this. It's that this gives us a new opportunity to talk to boys about the whole spectrum of consent, of coercion, of assault.
When this issue comes up as kind of a general systemic issue, I think there's a certain defensiveness that comes up out there. There's the hashtag not all men for a while where the idea is, okay, if you bring this up, you're accusing all men of, in effect, being potential rapists. That's not where you're coming from either, though, it sounds like.
Yeah, that makes me kind of tired, to be honest. No, you know, what I am saying is that I think it's pretty obvious when we look at the way that kids learn sexual behavior, that they do learn that boys are supposed to push. And I saw this all the time with the girls that I was interviewing for Girls and Sex, that they would talk about, you know, middle school. And it's complicated. You know, they talk about middle school dances where this first started happening and boys would come up behind them and you know, what they call grind, which is when they the boys push their genitals up against the girls' rear ends while the girls are facing the other way. And the girls, sometimes they, you know, they wanted that. Sometimes they liked that. But they had all learned at a certain point over time to, you know, to artfully disengage from that if they needed to without, you know, they would say without offending the boy. And they were always, you know, to a girl that I spoke with, they were always extremely worried about hurting boys' feelings, even when the boys weren't worried about, you know, the reverse. And the girls always, one of the big issues with girls is that they want to know how to say no without being seen as mean or being seen as the B word, or, you know, how do they disengage and leave the guy's ego intact?
But no reciprocal concern from the boy in that equation.
No, and you know, we pretty much accept the idea that, and again, I'm not saying this because boys are bad. I'm not saying this because boys are all, you know, rapists, nothing like that, obviously. I mean, that would be ridiculous. That would be absurd. But we do, you know, we do engage in a dynamic, and we encourage kids to engage in a dynamic in which, you know, boys pressure and girls concede. And I always think back when I was a kid to that. Remember that meat? I don't know how old you are, but remember that Meatloaf song, "Paradise by the
Dashboard Light"?
Yeah. And they have that sports narration in the middle of, which actually is a real sportscaster, I guess, a real baseball game, where he's, you know, he's going, "Holy cow, he's going to steal a base!" You know, all these things, and it's overtly comparing sex to baseball and the boy to the, actually, I think the girl in that metaphor is not actually the opposing team. I think she's the field on which the game is played.
Talking to Peggy Orenstein about boys, girls, sex, and consent. Back to our callers now with Deborah in Milwaukee. Deborah, hi.
Hi. You know, hi, Peggy. And this is a great topic that needs to be talked about. And I wonder why we don't teach kids sexual education when they are young. I mean, my son, when he went to German immersion school in the fourth grade, I saw this consent form. I'm like, what? They're teaching sex education in the fourth grade? At that point, they're like at a whole different level. But if you teach it to them like a medical student learns it, when they're very young, they'll grow up realizing, well, a penis is a penis and a breast is a breast, and it's part of a your human body. It's not, but now it's just so the pornography it's just disgusts me that this is how kids are learning about sex.
And Deborah, thanks for the call. Peggy, start earlier, she's saying.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a great book that I always recommend called From Diapers to Dating that is how to talk about sexual issues and consent issues to your child from the get-go, which is, by, you know, from the beginning, name, just as the caller said, naming proper parts. It's not, you know, you wouldn't tell somebody that their elbow is called their hoo-ha. You know, you have to name the names and moving on from there and talking about it in a way that's developmentally appropriate to kids and understanding what they're asking and what they're not asking. So, yeah, I think it's, you know, and it's part, it's also that we tend to put sex and sex education in this silo that's off to the side. And so then becomes really like scary and embarrassing to talk about instead of integrating ideas about consent and how we treat people and how we think about relationships, just like we integrate all kinds of conversations about how we treat friends, about bullying, about all of these things. They're all part of being, of teaching our kids how to be decent human beings in the world.
Peggy, briefly, as we wrap up, are you hopeful, are you optimistic that this isn't just maybe a teachable moment, but a moment that could be extended into an ongoing conversation?
You know, I am. And that's, I mean, I think that we've been seeing that around girls and around issues of consent on campus. And it's what I'm really seeing in going around talking about girls and sex. And I'm really hopeful that by the time I publish Boys and Sex, that we'll be ready for that conversation, too.
Peggy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Peggy Orenstein. She's the author of the book Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. As you heard, she's in the midst of research for a book on boys and sex. Her piece on masculinity, sexual assault, and consent that prompted this piece was in the New York Times Magazine. We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. You can have a look at it and share your thoughts with us on the Facebook page.
We're gearing up for election night coverage here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll have live coverage from WPR, NPR, and Wisconsin Public Television.
And a strange side effect, a weird sighting around the WPR studios yesterday, me in a tie.
How did that go for you?
Well, it was okay. So we filmed this TV promo, right, for this event that they're going to be showing. And, you know, I went into radio, among many other reasons, A, not to have people see me, and B, not to dress up. So it was weird, right?
Of course, right. And you probably had multiple takes.
Yeah, being on TV, I mean, the idea, like, well, other... So it makes me think of the debate, right? If you're on that split screen, I don't care what party or your opinions or anything like that, you have to stand there and not make weird faces while somebody's talking. I had a hard time doing that for like 10 seconds at a stand. Have you done TV style?
Not in front of the camera. Okay. But yes, you have a lot of control. And then there was that tie issue with Adam's apple all that. But the tie came off for Central Time.
I can't talk for long periods. It's just too constricting. I will say our colleagues over at Wisconsin Public Television did a great job keeping me at ease. Hopefully they'll do some digital editing to make me look, you know, like a normal human.
Sure it went well.
Watch for that, and watch for election night coverage here on WPR when the time comes. This is Central Time.